Welcome to Counter Stories, our regular conversation by people of color, for people of color, and everyone else. My name is Anthony Galloway. I'm the executive director of the Arts Us Center for African Diasporic Art and Culture.
I'm Don Eubanks, associate professor at Metropolitan State University and School of Social Work and cultural consultant.
I'm Brant Williams. I'm a correspondent at Minnesota Public Radio News.
And our regular panelists, Luz Maria Frias and Hli Lee, couldn't be with us today, but we have a very special guest, Ambar Hansen, who is joining us today. Welcome, Ambar.
Thank you for having me.
Ambar, since you're new to our group, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you come to us from?
Sure. Again, I'm Ambar. I work at Hiawatha Academies. It's a network of public schools, public charter schools in South Minneapolis. I've been living in Minnesota for the past 20-some years, 21 years to be exact. I came to Minnesota directly from the Dominican Republic. And so have been in Minnesota ever since, working in the community.
Well, welcome.
Yeah.
We got
you.
Folks from the DR in the building.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So, you know, as we talk about and connect around our identities, you know, we often as a group are encountering moments in not just political life, but moments in our experience in the United States where our identities are used against us or are used to conflate a whole lot of other issues. As long as America has been America, and I'm saying that very specifically to include North, South, East and West parts of America, not just the United States, as we assume. But in that space right now, there is a group of people who are fleeing violence and persecution and on a horrible experience, and they're making their way north. And our own president has politicized this, which is a migration that actually happens every year, never in this amount, but it's something that happens every year, and very few of them even reach the United States to begin with. But we've started to hear a layering of different conflations with identity and fear tactics and things like that that are associated with this group of folks who are fleeing. And so that was on our minds as we were talking. So I wanted to start us off with talking a little bit about what our experience has been and what we have seen and experienced as a result of this caravan of folks who are moving.
Well, I can definitely start. I know that, you know, for me, having the experience of having lots of family and community members that I'm very strongly tied to as immigrants has been, this is just yet another layer of fear tactics towards not just the communities that are coming and heading north, but to all of us here, right? And not to mention only for the Latinx community, but the fear tactics for other communities of color and immigrant communities as well. Most recently, and I know we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but most recently, the statements around the fact that they think that there are Middle Eastern folks there and associating them with terror. I mean, the layers of isms that are there are just incredibly disheartening and dehumanizing to our communities.
And it was funny. I was in a conversation and it was with a group of youth and they're an anti-racist student leadership network of youth. And we're having a conversation about this. And a couple of the students just said, do folks understand this is a non-starter with me? Like, you're not going to start a conversation with this kind of language and think that it's going to appeal to me at all, but it definitely appeals to somebody. And that concern was real on the faces of these youth who will take a line. There's Middle Eastern in this group. There's rapists and murderers in this group and all these things that are put onto a group of folks fleeing, not dealing at all with the humanitarian issue that's right there where the students really want to go. And it's not just seeing it in the newspaper. These kids are seeing it in the hallways. So somebody goes and they take that language, and then kids are parroting that language around, and fights and confrontations are happening around as well. You know, so this idea that this is just a news story statement that happens in that arena. No, there's real effect for people of color on the ground.
Right. And it perpetuates it promotes white supremacy, right? Because then we also hear our youth in the Latinx community talking about now we're scared that there's, you know, Middle Eastern, like that it perpetuates internalized racism as well as the racism that is the blanket that is all across. So that's part of the I think part of the tactic around this that further it just divides our communities in more way than one. So on the one hand, you're perpetuating oppression to all of these Latinx and indigenous communities coming from the south up north around the anti-immigrant sentiment. Mm-hmm. And then you're creating further divisions by saying, and one of the reasons that we don't want them to come is because now there's this other community mm-hmm. that we also hate and fear, right? That is with them. And so the just tactics underlying that are just really, really scary in terms of what we're ingraining into our communities at large, not just our youth.
You know, what I find absolutely amazing about some of the comments made by our president in that arena is how he pulls these things out of thin air and just throws it in the mix. It gets covered. It's broadcast on media. It's shown on TV. And it fuels his base. And because I sit there and I hear him utter these things, and my jaw drops in utter amazement that this is even coming out of his mouth. Based on what? He would have his base believe that these folks are flying over from the Middle East all the way to Guatemala just so that they can get in this walk to the United States. How much sense does that even make?
Well, it all seems to come from this, this which we've been seeing, this alternate universe type of reality we're in now, where there used to be, and it's also particularly troubling to me as a journalist, not to mention just as a person who tries to be a reality-based person, is to seeing this websites and bloggers and folks who come up with, they just throw things out there. It used to be those types of claims were roundly kind of put down, and people were like, well, there's no validity to this. It's just a little, this is one of these rumors. But we see, it seems to be like the president maybe is reading these or somebody whispers to him, hey, did you read this in this blog here about this? There are terrorists embedded with this caravan coming up from Central America. And he broadcasts it as well. And of course, when the president says something, the mainstream media, we also broadcast that. It's like, hey, here's what the leader of the free world is saying, and he's saying something that maybe you haven't heard of because maybe you don't subscribe to these particular sources of information that the president is. That to me is also very interesting, and it keeps going on and on and on.
You know, one of the things that is interesting that's coming up now is there is some fracturing to this kind of black bubble thing that I've been experiencing, not just with family members and friends who share very different political views than I am. We're often in huge debates because I have a very healthy critique of liberalism as well as it relates to the experiences of people of color in the United States. We don't spend nearly enough time on that. however, I'm seeing some fracturing from particularly my Republican friends who will call themselves very staunch conservatives, but they feel very unrepresented. These are people of color I'm talking about.
Okay.
As well.
All right.
And so they feel very unrepresented because they would consider themselves socially liberal and fiscally conservative if they were to put that's often how they describe themselves. So we end up very much in the same place on a whole lot of issues, and our debates are very much around, you know, very minute in the weeds like methods to get to the same destination, right? So it never comes to knock down, drag out fight.
Right.
But now in there's starting to be this space where a lot of them are getting hit in these conversations because they're taking these positions that once the facts start coming out there, they're stopping and having to go, whoa, hold up. And now they're having to peel back all this stuff that they thought because their echo chamber is telling them something that's so far from actual reality. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to get real incensed and angry around it to the point where now they're not saying anything. Mm-hmm. And so there's this interesting thing that's happening where they're pulling back to not say anything because they need more time to make sure something is true. And in that space of not saying anything, there's nothing stopping the folks who are just pulling all kinds of stuff out there that's completely baseless and unfounded with zero fact base, and there's nothing bumping into that anymore. And I'm curious about what that'll continue to look like, especially as people try to politicize this group of folks fleeing a humanitarian disaster.
Right.
Not to, you know, at the same time as we have famine in Yemen, that is the worst that we've ever, one of the worst that we've ever seen in our modern experience. Like, what is distracting us from both the real root cause issues while we talk about big air quotes, Middle Eastern folks that, you know, and then my Middle Eastern friends hearing that going, what the hell?
it really doesn't make any sense.
None
and yet
whatsoever.
It goes into the news and the media, and people see that one kind of quote, and it makes it fact, right? It's not fact, and yet people believe that and internalize that. And to me, that's part of the divide and conquer. It continues to perpetuate that divide and conquer. Divide our communities, right? Instill fear into the white community. Divide our communities of color in some way, shape, or form, and then conquer. And that's what continues to happen. It's happening in all of our communities, you know, whether it be dividing our African American families through incarceration, our Native American families through, you know, schools and everything there, yep, and our Latinx families through immigration, right? So it's, and this is the small piece that feeds. It's like, we don't want you here. We don't like that you're coming, but there's also this other community that, you know, we're going to make sure that you're working against and not with in order to be able to create any kind of equity or equality, because as long as you fear each other, then we're good. We're good to go.
You know, when I think, because I think about this stuff, unfortunately, because I teach in social work program at Metro, and one of the classes I teach is ethnic analysis and comparative racial analysis. But last night on TPT, there was a program, the beginning of a program called Native Americans, from caves to colonialism, I think it was. So it started with these ancient cities that have been discovered in Central America, and also the cave dwellings in the Southwest, as being these, you know,
elaborate, huge
civilizations and cities. But what I found amusing with this, even though there's this attempt to try to give a legitimate background on the history of indigenous populations here, it was still done in the context of these early Americans. And I thought, how could they be early American? America didn't exist. So even within that context, even in this attempt to try to put a better or a truer historical account of my ancestors, it was still done in that context. And I'm saying that because when I think about our cousins coming here from Guatemala, this entire continent, north, south, central, whatever, is our homeland.
Right.
We moved about freely at will, wherever we wanted to, until European Americans showed up. And, you know, the Spaniards and everyone else. And then they created these artificial boundaries. And then all of a sudden, our movement begins to be dictated by them on where we can and can't go. In North America and the United States, I find it interesting that one cannot call themselves Indian unless they get federal approval. I mean, think about that. So this carries over. So when I hear this fear being placed on our cousins coming here for better life, to a country that essentially was here when they were here, had lived here with everyone else, and we move around, and now they're coming home for all practical purposes, and they're being told they can't.
Well, and as you're talking, it's making me also think about, you know, the census, right? And again, this idea, you're talking about, you know, our cousins coming here, and yet when the Latinx community comes to the United States, it's forced to pick a box, right? So, and what's happening is it's getting racialized towards whiteness, because even though there might be indigenous blood, the, you know, colonization and survival and everything, it's like, you identify as Latinx and white, even though nobody else is going to see you as that potentially, but that's how you have internalized your identity based on your historical context and where you come from and everything else. And that's dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. That's because then that's again perpetuating this because of what some of it also related to what you said, like unless you are identified federally, right, as Indian, as you know, being part of Indian country, you don't get that. You don't get to pick that box.
So it's funny. It's just funny to hear this. I run a Pan-African center, a cultural center, and one of the conversations that gets had as the intersection comes in there is the struggle around identity, right? If we're going to sit down and have a conversation about the Black experience, if we exclude out the Latin America, then we're excluding 80% of where captive Africans were taken in the slave trade. Yeah. And so we've been having a hard time really helping folks to understand that you can have a multigenerational African-American identity. No one wants to deny that, right? So we have folks who will say, I am Black. And I say that to call out that particular history in a very Cornel Westian approach to thinking. But I also have a Pan-African identity that must include the largest population of African peoples outside of the continent of Africa or in Latin America. Mm. And so if I have that, if I'm able to do that conversation, then this conversation about our cousins also can be real from a Pan-African sense, because if you're Latinx, you're having to cope with a European identity, an indigenous identity, and an African identity. Right. And are we willing to do that? And the division that comes with this type of rhetoric really saddens me, because there are folks in the Black community who are also picking up these talking points of rhetoric in this kind of nationalistic xenophobia that it stops me all completely in my tracks, because I'm like, wait, hold on. You know the same history I know. So how is it that we are looking at this not as our cousins, or the fact that we had a history of fleeing the South in the Great Migration for better jobs, better access, and the same exact reasons that these folks are going, and yet I'm going to sit you as other? Come on now.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking of that same thing. I started reading Warmth of Other Suns.
Oh, yeah.
And
Isabella Wilkerson.
And I actually got a chance to meet her at a National Association of Black Journalists conference some years ago. And during the session, she was talking. She actually asked people who are attending her session to talk about their own, if they had similar types of stories, their own family migrations and what they were based on. Mm-hmm. And like many African-American families, I mean, my family came from, my dad's side of the family came out of Oklahoma, where there was no economic opportunity whatsoever. They came north to Michigan to work in the factories and the auto plants.
After Black Wall Street was burned.
Exactly. Well, yeah, there are many, but her book, of course, is littered with stories of people who were suffering terrorism. They were terrorized, and she considered them American refugees, refugees within their own country. And so I can't help but always make those parallels when I see groups of people migrating from south of our borders, from across the ocean to come to this country because they're suffering from a condition. I mean, let's be clear. People don't want to leave their homeland on a whim. It's got to be something very, very terrible that's happening to them.
And that's where our focus should be. I mean, let's look at the data. Even if every single one of the estimated 7,000 or more came to the United States, there is nothing that will be disrupted from a data standpoint if they all came here.
On the contrary.
Come on with it.
We need a workforce here. We need, we need the diversity. We need to be thriving in different ways. Like, we actually have shortages in many parts of our country. So it doesn't make sense from a humanitarian point, it doesn't make sense for us to do this. And from an economic point, it doesn't make sense for us to do this either. But
we do not have an immigration issue, as you call out. And in addition to all of that, what are we doing about what's happening back home? And let's be clear, a lot of what's pushing them out was what we did in Honduras and what we did in Bolivia and what we did in many of these places. So we are culpable in the reason why these folks have to leave their space in the first place. And we are unwilling to address that, yet we're going to villainize the people who flee violence.
So history repeating itself in terms of, I think the same treatment that that European Americans have bestowed upon African Americans here, Native Americans, indigenous populations, and through corporations and government have done the same thing in all these other countries. And but, you know, what allows an individual to demonize and criminalize individuals fleeing for a better opportunity is because the average American does not know nor really cares about that history. So it's like, you know, teaching these subjects in school or just asking my students a simple question, how many reservations are there in Minnesota? Hmm. And not a single student has been able to answer that question. I know you know it, Anthony, because I bring it up. And, you know, but I'm just saying, so the lack of true education, you know, the fact that our populace couldn't explain that scenario. And, I mean, think about it. Who walks? How far is Guatemala to America?
Thousands of miles.
Who walks that?
Yeah. You have to be to the point where you already have nothing else to lose.
And then, so there's, so the last figure I've heard, whether this is true or not, Amber, it was like 6,000 to 7,000 individuals.
Yeah.
So you have 6,000 to 7,000 people walking to the United States. Are they going to sneak through? I mean, it's this whole idea that all of us, you know, here's, and these people are coming to apply legally
for
refugee status, for asylum. Yep. So it's not like these 7,000 people are coming to this wall that is going to either be there or not be there and then break the wall down and then come rushing across the border. No, that's going to happen. They're going to come. They're applying for asylum. And so...
But this is the exact point that incensed particularly the Latinx students.
Which is a legal process. Right.
But this is what incensed some of the Latinx students in the conversation that we were having around this, and that is now we're stuck having a conversation in defense of why these folks have moved and not having a conversation about the root cause issues that we need to actually be addressing and put in to make some action around how we help these folks. And that's the thing that was pissing them off.
That's important. I mean, nobody's talking about there are, you know, it is to seek asylum and it is legal for them to be able to go through this process. And nobody, to your point, is definitely talking about the fact that, you know, we had plantations, American plantations in Honduras that did a lot to take away land from people, jobs from people, perpetuated poverty, you know, all of that has, you know, the conflicts that we've been embedded in Latin America in some way, shape or form. Nobody's talking about that. They're just talking about a group of people that are fleeing their country, you know, and coming to take over somehow, and at least making it sound like that's what's happening.
That reminds me about the quote that I had mentioned earlier that President Trump used at the Naval Academy this summer, right? Back in May, where he said that, you know, we were not going to be apologetic for taming a continent. And what are the implications with that statement, right? We're not going to be apologetic for taming an entire continent. And to me, a continent includes not only North America, it includes Central America, it includes South America. And that statement in and of itself, I think, perpetuates what we're seeing him do now, because they're not going to be apologetic. You know, when you talk about those plantations down in Honduras, I immediately thought of the plantations here at Cotton. The same colonization, the same taking of the land, and for its purposes of only for making money, and then everything else that comes from that has, you know, has been borne on our backs.
Right.
And that the whistle underneath it, and that's there's so many layers we have to peel back just to have a cogent dialogue about what's happening here, and that's part of the frustration, particularly in my community circles, because we've seen this happen. When, you know, if you're a student of history, you know that this kind of layered rhetoric was wrapped around in the Civil War to entice poor whites to fight against their own interests. The same thing was done in the Nadir part of race relations in the early 1900s, as many of the Southern planters and folks began to get power again and get their seats back in Congress. And so this rhetoric is always a marker for a change that has meant for communities of color in particular, but I'm speaking from the African-American perspective, has always been a marker that preempted legislation, policies, and redressing of rights and things like that, and an emboldening of folks who are in resistance to black bodies. Again, speaking from a black experience, but it has been experienced in multiple experiences, mm-hmm. too.
Are you saying that there are politicians who are trying to use fear as a way to exploit the...
So here's one of the challenges, right? One of the tactics is, you know, nobody's consciously doing this stuff, but this stuff is so ingrained that you don't have to consciously do it, but the pattern continues to be the same over and over again.
So, Anthony, maybe to help illustrate that point, what was the party of Lincoln?
Very complicated, right?
Right.
Because Lincoln, if he could have stopped the war without ending slavery in his own
sure,
words,
he would have done that.
It.
But the party of Lincoln was Republican
party. Correct.
Right? And after after the emancipation, mm-hmm. then it kind of forced other issues. And so the Republicans at that time mm-hmm. then began to carry and started to attack when Southern Democrats mm-hmm. begin to institute Jim Crow and all the things to yep. put in place in order to get the power back and to remove that black vote. It was during that time that the rhetoric began to change,
yep.
right? And as they began to attack Jim Crow, that's when we saw the switch from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party.
And that switch has happened cyclically from the start of the United States. And so I was actually an NPR story I heard where somebody had written a book about the cycles of these shifts as the parties, people in the parties begin to shift. Because once you lose, you
right.
figure out a way to jump into a winning side and just put some of those policies back into the mix.
But there's this retaliation, right? So if we were to look at another common day, maybe analogy or an experience. Recently, two, 3 years ago, we had Standing Rock
yep.
in North Dakota, where Native Americans were standing up for their right to prevent this pipeline from contaminating their reservation, their homeland. It was very contentious between North Dakota and indigenous populations in North Dakota. There's an election in North Dakota, like any other state, for governor and many other seats. And so recently there was a bill passed that was upheld by the North Dakota Supreme Court that essentially
the U.S.
was
Supreme Court.
Supreme Court, you're mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. that upheld North Dakota's law that stated that in order to vote, one needed to have a street address to be able to prove where you live in order to vote. In rural America, especially on reservations, they don't have streets or street mm-hmm. numbers. All members on a reservation are assigned P.O. boxes. So this law effectively locks out Native Americans from voting. Who was going to vote as a result of that pipeline coming through their tribal yep. lands, mm-hmm. right? Native Americans were incensed over their environmental injustice that was bestowed upon them by the state of North Dakota. They were going to vote. Those folks were upset. And this law is now suppressing their ability to go vote. I bring that up because it's just another current day example of disenfranchisement of our communities mm-hmm. in the United States.
And that's what I was alluding to with the whenever this type of rhetoric starts to pop up, immediately my radar goes off to start looking and go, okay, what else is happening around?
Exactly.
Because that has been the pattern. And so you have the North Dakota disenfranchisement. You have things going on in Georgia as a result of the gutting of the voting rights bill. So now we have, just recently, we have a whole slew of ballots that are being thrown out because of inconsistent signatures without doing any work to check with the person who actually voted to get a chance to contest.
Yeah.
Right. You have the removing of folks from voting rolls to say that you haven't been voting for a while. Right. So on a surface, that seems all right, except you might have two folks with the same name. all of these, this addressing of the processes for voting with zero evidence that there is a problem with the voting system outside of Russia, right?
Well, what did they do down in Georgia?
Well, I'll preface by just saying from kind of the reality-based world, mm-hmm. In which I hold on to as best I can sometimes. Stats show that we don't vote as nearly as much as we are allowed to or mm-hmm. are able to. There are so many people who fought so hard.
When you say
so
we, who do you mean?
Americans in general.
Okay,
United States. Yeah, yes, in the United States.
Okay.
People just don't turn out to the polls right. in very large numbers, you know, compared to the voting age.
Yeah.
So I'm looking for that evidence to show that, no, the problem is there's actually too many people voting who are not eligible to vote.
Right.
That just doesn't seem to be happening.
Or voting more than once.
Exactly. Voting more than once. Yeah. That's, you know, that people are taking the time to get up and, you know, vote legally and then vote illegally.
Yes.
And so far, I haven't seen any evidence of that.
None
so
whatsoever.
You, or all of any the evidence points to the contrary. Right. Right?
Exactly.
If, you know, it's not to say that would that ever happen? Probably. Does it happen enough for us to warrant pushing out hundreds, if not thousands, of voters in our communities? Absolutely not.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I've done stories on. I do a lot of stories on gun legislation, and through those stories, I've spoken with a lot of people who are very staunch defenders of the Second Amendment. And I remember having conversations with one particular advocate, and I asked him. I said, "Well, you know, put this in the context of, do you support voter ID laws?" And he's like, "Yeah, I do." I go, there's probably, if we look at just by sheer numbers, the incidence of in-person voter fraud are so low, are you willing to make it more difficult or to err on the side of making it harder for people to vote in the fear that one person or so many people might be voting illegally? So you're willing to do that, but you are also, this person was also in favor of constitutional carry, which means basically you can, as long as you can, you're legally able to buy a gun, you don't need to get an actual permit to carry it on your person. And he said, yeah, I you know, hey, it's, he was telling me that he would rather a person be able to, there's restrictions be on voter rights and not on gun rights, not to be as strict on gun rights. And so again, I'm trying to go from a, you know, and I'm like, look, just show me the numbers that show that it's better for this country for people to have more restrictions on voting and less restrictions on firearms possession. And I didn't get a good answer.
But the argument is very familiar because it's a very similar argument that show me where somebody would say, show me how the institution of slavery benefits me as a poor white person who now has to compete with the free labor force versus having to compete with folks on the same level without a corporation or a company or somebody just being able to go, I don't need you as a worker. I'm just going to go get a bunch of free folks in captivity. Right. And that didn't change after slavery because we had the prison labor that also was. So, again, we have folks who are advocating against their own interests based on talking points and based on this rhetoric. And that is driving a whole lot of folks to go along with efforts to suppress votes. And this doesn't just affect communities of color. And that's, it's always been a hard link to try to make for folks because the rhetoric is so strong.
And the rhetoric is not only strong, but people are in bubbles, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of the challenge is how do we ensure more people are listening to this show, right? How do we ensure that the facts are put in front of folks across the country instead of, you know, having one outlet of news that just informs folks and then you're surrounded by people that continue to perpetuate that message regardless of, I mean, that's what's happening. We are not everybody's getting to have that person, that logical person in front of them that's asking them this question. And even when you do ask this question, they still give you the same answer because they're so convoluted by all of these other folks behind them saying, this is the way it needs to be. This is the right way of doing things.
And, you know, Don, what you just said, Ambar, makes me think of something that Don says repeatedly for Native communities, right? The lesser of two evils is always what you're voting for. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, and it just dawned on me because me and my wife were again watching that documentary 13th by Ava DuVernay. And as we're going through there, we're reminded that you may have a rhetoric around conservatism that upsets you as a person of color, particularly as a black person. You may have language on the right that upsets you, but we have policy on the left that put you in jail. Mm-hmm. A lot of our incarceration practices and policies, regardless of what the rhetoric is on the right, a lot of the major leaps in the growth in our incarceration came out of the left. And so we're stuck in a space of going, we want to have this real dialogue, but you feel locked into one party to keep this thing over, when really, when we actually have a logical, real argument based on facts, all of us are jettisoning both a lot of the talking points on all sides in that space. But we can't ever get to a real dialogue because the nuance is so deep. And we know this as folks of color. Whenever somebody asks us about one particular cultural thing, I have to go, okay, well, you have to know about all this stuff, and I may have 30 minutes to talk to you, and 27 of those minutes is going to be giving you the background that you need to address the one point that you're asking about in the first place.
Yes.
So there's no way to have a real cogent discourse in our bubbles and in our media flash minutes, because no one's walking around with any of the nuance and context.
Well, and I think that reminds me of, I mean, on my father's side of the family, who were socially conservative and Christian. My dad used to vote Republican for a while until Obama ran for president. But I just remember overhearing, you know, in family conversations that a bit of social conservatism, but not, but was very pro-black in, you know, very pro-civil rights way. Mm-hmm. That old school Republican civil rights type of the 60s type of you know, those types of Republicans. So it always kind of blew my mind when I heard people start to criticize, when you hear older black men say to young men, hey, you know, you need to, you know, pull up your pants and do that kind of thing. I mean, to me that sounded like old grandpa talk, you know, which I took out of a sense of love, and out of a sense of, well, this is kind of our, you know, that grand history. I would have to explain to them in that, you know, go back and say, well, this may be a reason why grandpa would say, pull up your pants, because he grew up in a time when if you, you know, you didn't present yourself in a certain way, you could get your head cracked by a police officer and taken somewhere, you know, and you might not come back, you know.
But I'm part of grandpa logic, though, because in our center, you ain't walking in that space with your pants hanging down your kneecaps.
Right, right. So it's like, but then, you know, then you hear, like, you know, some young white kids say, well, that's kind of, you know, that's a kind of racism and that kind of thing. I'm like, you know, there's a complexity here that we need to be able to talk about. And as you're saying, you know, I'm going to have to give you a 30-minute backgrounder on where this type of attitude comes from in my community. And there's not much time to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, just going along with what Anthony just said, and that's something that I think we all struggle with. Even on this program, there are times where we talk about ideas, concepts, and without providing the background for some of our listeners. I mean, so for instance, you know, just, you know, another analogy of what Anthony was just talking about is this common phrase about pull yourself up by your bootstraps and go the whole nine yards. Well, you know, or someone saying, my grandparents came over to this country as immigrants and were able to work hard and succeed. Why don't you do the same? It goes back to that analogy we're making, that we create the situation and then turn around and vilify the folks who were victimized. And so when I hear those comments, so a part of me believes the individual who's making that comment actually believes what they're saying, because they have not learned or heard about how this country was really set up, and or has no understanding how all these things were put in place that prevented African Americans, Native Americans, and other communities of color from prospering or being a part of that American dream. We simply couldn't tie our bootstraps and go the whole nine yards because we weren't allowed in the unions. We weren't hired in the factories. There were all these things in place that prevented us, let alone all the other policies in terms of not even being able to buy a house, or the fact that I talked about when my dad returned from World War II, a GI, a war veteran from World War II, he was not allowed to access the GI Bill. So when the average American is not aware of those things.
Average United States citizen.
Thank you. Honestly believes what they're saying, because in their experience, that's what happened. Not realizing that we weren't allowed that opportunity. And then the time it takes for us to explain why that's not true, by the time you get 15 minutes into that, their eyes are rolling in the back of their head.
You know, let me channel our friend Luz at this time, because I think she would bring in, as we're talking about the upcoming election and some of these measures that have been happening in different states that on their face appear to be just plain old voter suppression.
Yeah,
I think Luz might, and I see a bit of this as well. Perhaps this is also a period when there's a great awakening among people to remind them of the importance of voting and getting out and actually, it's like just because there are barriers in your way that you can still do this. And point in particular is in Florida, there's a ballot measure which would make it easier for disenfranchised folks who have been through the criminal justice system to get their citizen, their ability to vote back.
More,
automatically instead of having to go through this process, which made it nearly impossible for So talk about
along with measures in California, you know, in Minnesota, one of the things that we've been trying to do is to get a fact sheet out there. There's a great Secretary of State fact sheet out there that says what steps you can take as a person who has served your time. Mm-hmm. One of the confusions can be is you may be off of parole, but in Minnesota, you have to be completely off paper.
Yeah.
So there's a supervisory status that's not technically parole that could also hand tie you from being able to vote and exercise your voting right, which we know to Luz, as she's given the data here in her previous conversations to Luz's point, that voting and participation in regular citizenship activities has great effects to prevent recidivism because you feel a better complete part of the community, right? Folks don't vandalize stuff that they hold sacred, right? So take it from somebody who runs a center in a public park space. Like when kids know and have deep respect for a space, they don't mess with our stuff. And we don't have to worry about that.
If you think about all of the movements that have, you know, risen because of all, you know, there's so many movements that are rising now in terms of making sure that people do have the right to vote. You think of when I'm thinking of youth, and this is not related to voters specifically, but it's related in the sense that now you've got your dreamers and your DACA recipients pushing, right, for those that can vote to vote, you know, and to make sure that they're doing it, remembering like we are part of this community too. So so there, to your point, when you hold something sacred, you try to make sure that it's protected. And so there is this great awakening of, and people who typically would have said, I'm not voting, I don't care, it doesn't impact me. Well, people are starting to realize it does impact me. It impacts me and my family and everybody around me in ways that I didn't necessarily pay attention to, because they did before, but I wasn't paying attention to it. Right. And so now that's shifting as well.
Well, like the youth vote, that's another population that is maybe not the most reliable voting population, but again, with after the school shootings and youth being mobilized to tell their legislators, hey, look, if I'm not voting, even though I may not be voting this year, I'm going to be turning 18 next time you're up for re-election, and here's what I'm going to tell you right now that I'm concerned about, and this is what's motivating me to vote. That may be, again, another one of these awakenings that we're seeing is a lot of young people are making a lot of I'm not going to say noise, but they're getting out there and having their voices heard about the issues that they're concerned about, and they're speaking
they're leading
Yeah.
And putting it out there, like one of the things that I loved was there was a forum we're at where some of the youth were leading a discussion about a whole lot of things, but it got into the voting space. And they were like, and a couple of youth are like, well, let's put a youth platform out there that says we're going to be only supporting candidates who are willing to put a stamp out there and make it easier to vote. Why don't we vote on Saturdays? Why do we have to worry about all these different pieces? Why can't we make it easier for folks to vote? And there was a huge disconnect right there, because then you had a group of students, and this is regardless of racial background and across many different identity spectrums. It was funny because it split all of a sudden, because half the students were like, well, why do we have to go all the steps to me? You should be voting anyway, because that's the right you're supposed to do. And then the other half, who's stuck now in this debate with the nuance issue, because why are so many folks disillusioned? Well, all of this history, we are the most vulnerable populations for any changes that make it harder to vote are overrepresented in the most vulnerable populations.
Young people have power. I've seen it in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. All right. So as I was coming up during the Vietnam War, and so we could be drafted at 18. At that time, in mid-60s, you could be drafted at 18, but you couldn't drink, you couldn't smoke, you couldn't do anything until you're an adult at 21. And youth rebelled against that, and they changed the law. And so by the time I was in high school, now we could vote at 18. And so youth does have power. And you're so right. I mean, I think, you know, I remember the first time Obama ran for office, and I went to my polling place, which was right across the alley from where I live, and the place was packed. Mm-hmm. And not only was it packed, because it's usually when I go vote, I'm usually looking at my neighbors and where I live. Most of them are white, and most of them are older than 55 years old. And they'll be in line waiting to vote. For that first Obama election, it was filled with young folks. And I was blown away because I'd never seen so many voting. And I hope they turn out. I just hope they turn out because, you know, you need to vote. I mean, when folks are telling us that we don't matter, right, that we as people, Native Americans, African Americans, Latinos, and other folks of color in this country, we're being told right to our face we don't matter.
And it's, and part of it is connected to this 50% plus one scenario that we have been in our recent in our, you know, I think it's raging on now. We're in that 50 plus one space, whereas before elections tended to have wider margins, and you know, except for sometimes where the issues were real, real close, and once we're in that space, you know, on one side it seems like, well, now every single vote counts, and you have a whole lot more attention. But in reality, what we're seeing is it's pushing down smaller populations who you only matter as long as the vote ability, right? And so, if we vote in larger numbers, what'll likely happen is we will have much stronger mandates.
A mandate, yeah.
For, you know, for different issues and not just parties, but for particular things when more of the populace can weigh in. Without that, we're stuck in this space where you only matter in so much as the vote matters. And really what that's saying is you don't.
Well, and one thing that brings me some kind of hope and optimism is that we're not just turning out to vote. We are also turning out to run for office. So, and I think that's really important is we have more people of color running in this election. And I'm sure as, you know, in the coming years, this will continue to happen than we ever have had before, which is really, you know, it's really exciting. I mean, at the local level, we've had, you know, women of color running against each other. Yes. Like we need to have more people from our communities running at the gubernatorial, at the state level. We have women of color running. We have people of color running. This is really exciting. So it's not just our vote. It's that we are stepping up in many different more, we are stepping up and leaning in ways that we haven't before as much, because there hasn't been this drive to like my community, my rights are at stake, and these are they always have been, and we've always had this historic like movement mm-hmm. and momentum and cycle, but this is a different way in which we're stepping in and stepping up, which is really exciting. And if we can get to that point where we actually have representation at the state and local and national level when it comes to politics from our communities, like we would be talking a whole different game in this country.
Very much so. And you said a very important thing, and that is the lean in, right? One of the things at play is the willingness to stay in the messy space where it's harder to wrap your head around things yeah. and the nuance of that and complexity of that. Mm-hmm. That's a more human experience to borrow from James Baldwin's kind of essential points. That human experience that we engage in is a tough and complex one. But we do so much better and we have such better outcomes when we lean into the mess and complexity and allow ourselves to stay there instead of being in a space where we need things to be so simple. And maybe, just maybe, we want things to be so simple because we are scared of what happens when we deal with the baggage. Mm-hmm. But that's what conversations like Counter Stories are designed to do, is to weed into the messy stuff and deal with the baggage that's there and actually get some real healing.
Yeah.
Ambar, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Anthony Galloway.
Don Eubanks.
I'm Bud Hansen.
And Brant Williams.
And we'll see you next time.